This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 31st of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 343 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be sitting down with a regular Monocle voice who's now put his experience reporting on Egypt and the events of the Arab Spring into a new book, The Egyptians, A Radical Story. We'll be asking Jack Schenker where the country is headed next.
Later in the show, we'll also be talking to Maria Konnikova, the psychology writer whose new book asks how confidence tricksters perfect their murky art and why do we always fall for it, Rob?
And we'll be looking at the perhaps not immediately apparent links between Soviet-era Russia and art emerging from nations across Africa. Mark Nash, curator of new show Things Fall Apart, will be with us later.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be forecasting upcoming stories with a news look ahead, and we'll play some rather good music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a beautiful week it's been. Cold and crisp, a little bit warm around the edges. And yes, that's right. I'm talking about the Andrew Tuck weather forecast and what kind of mood he's been in this week.
Okay, so the good things are regular fox visitor to...
You like that, don't you?
I came in just today and the fox was sitting out there again, casually looking over the little ledge we have outside our window into the park, thinking about life. I like the fox. So the fox is good. Tick.
I saw a little redhead pouring at your trouser cuff earlier this week and I didn't know what to make of it.
I told him not to do that. And then there was a bit of a nice sunny afternoon here. Ooh, I felt like the spring was in the old step. That was good.
Yeah, very good.
Plus all those important things. We sent another issue to print. We've almost finished the giant How to Build a Nation book. That's only taken... Well, actually, it's taken as long for Steve to edit that book as actually to build your own nation.
Build a Nation. And that does come with an accompanying... Airfix model, doesn't it? You can glue it together. You can put, it's got stickers, got paints. You build your own nation.
And then we're finally putting. I'm not going to go do that because I want to get
Andrew,
one.
But, oh, no, I want for our listeners' benefit that Andrew is actually ticking things off.
I am ticking. So, yeah. And then I want to get one other plug in, which is the Monocle Conference happening in Vienna. It's going to be great. Book your ticket. Go online now because I've been booking amazing speakers. Okay. And, I think that's it, Richie. Well, not for the whole show. That's it for my chat.
Right, well, that's Andrew's shopping list done. Yeah. If you get down the Waitrose near the Brunswick Centre in central London, you will see him ticking more things off a list live. But coming up next, it's Tom Edwards.
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape aflutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land! Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
And here he is now.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you both?
Very good, thank you.
Spiffing.
You're all smiling.
Now you've got a playful look in your eye.
No, it's just
normally the portent of something bad.
No. Normally you come in with that kind of look of thunder. You've got kind of...
Do you know what? This is my sunshine disposition.
Yeah,
this is a new thing for you guys. Okay. How do you feel about it?
It's very good. I've also noticed you've got a bit of a kind of an extra curl going on with your hair. You've got quite curly today.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm growing it out.
It's quite McEnroe, isn't it? I'm thinking sweatband, wooden racket.
Yeah,
all that.
I'm thinking
short shorts, but I wish you weren't wearing them on the radio.
I'm thinking like rare.
Rob, please don't break the illusion.
I'm thinking rare breed sheep myself. Yeah.
I could go there.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounded weird, but yes.
You're just trying to crowbar in the phrase longhorn, aren't you?
Do you think have I got an ovine quality? Is that a sheep adjective? You like that one? Bit Latin?
Love it, yeah.
You're more lupine, I think.
Okay.
Hey. Yeah.
Bear. That's a wolf, isn't it?
No.
Lupine is
a
wolf.
Oh, lupine and wolf. Yeah. No, ursine.
Ursine.
Yeah. Oh, go on. Back to my Latin lessons again.
You don't know your urs from your elbow, Andrew.
Oh!
Oh, there we go.
Anyway, let's do some news.
Literally brilliant. What's happening in the news? I don't even care anymore.
Well, you know, I like to sort of wet our listeners' appetites and yours.
You wet your what?
I like to. I try not to wet myself during the weekly. No, what are some of our globe-trotting staff up to? And I'm excited about this. Our leather-faced colleague, Thomas Lewis, has been dispatched to cover the Iowa caucus for us. Okay. He's on the election trail, and he's going to be getting up to all sorts of mischief. We might have even heard from him. Maybe we'll hear from him later on the weekend edition this afternoon, I'm not sure. But he's certainly going to be popping up Monday and Tuesday across Monocle 24.
Great. And I'm also looking forward to seeing how the North American media treat a celebrity of the stature of Leonardo DiCaprio. Or is it Jude Law? Or is it Johnny Depp? Or is it Brad Pitt? Or is it some very handsome American film thinks he's being...
He's the man of 1,000 incredibly debonair and handsome identities. Yeah.
A lot of people think I look like Leo DiCaprio. Yeah. I went to the Frieze Art Fair and I got the absolute golden treatment. That's Thomas Lewis.
That's fantastic.
But he's not only is he phenomenally self-aggrandizing in that sense, but it doesn't matter. He always forgets which handsome film star he looks like. So then the next day it's Jude Law or something like that.
I know. And yet everyone knows that he actually looks like the upside down face boy from Family Guy. Dead ringer. Absolute dead ringer. So there you go. Life's rich.
There'll be lots of pictures in the press of why is Leonardo DiCaprio outside the convention centre smoking
like a
cigarette.
Points, yeah. Oh dear. That's completely distracted me.
Poor old Tom.
Okay, and that's his reputation
and actually,
sorted.
And he will be doing some fantastic reporting. He knows that market incredibly well. Used to be in the sort of Washington Bureau for another big international news organization. So he'll be bringing all
another
his,
big international news organization.
Yeah, like Monocle 24.
Oh, right, okay.
Come on, Rob, keep up.
Sorry.
What else is happening? Tuesday, this is one I thought, Rob, this might tickle your fancy somewhat. I don't know why. It's World Tutu Day. We're not talking about Desmond. We're not talking about
one of my favourite media-friendly clerics.
Not a second rate university degree. No, ballet. World Tutu Day. Gentlemen, will you be?
Who doesn't fancy ballerinas or ballet dancers?
Yeah, get involved. Wear a tutu, Andrew. Maybe Tuesday.
Yeah.
I prefer it on a Wednesday. That's my sort of regular day. I don't want to mix it up again.
Okay, no, indeed. You'll always see Andrew helping people into their tutus at 7 as well. A stockinged foot protruding from the dressing room door.
Why did I bring that up? They might be hard to say.
See you down the Sandlers.
Christ.
I will like that. How will I find out about that? Is there somewhere I can go and look at pictures?
I think it'll be obvious if someone's partaking in it. You don't have to kind of ask many questions.
Oh, heavens. Look, time is short. Shall we just jump into a piece of international hysterica? Yeah. I know that we both like that. Three of us like that. This is one I've never heard of before. The Battle of the Oranges.
Oh, this is
Have you heard
one.
Of this?
No.
So this is at Centro Storico in Borghetto in Ivrea in Italy. Apologies to our Italian listeners if I've butchered those. It's a carnival. It celebrates the people's revolt against tyranny. And what happens in the Battle of the Oranges, unprotected people on foot who represent the ordinary citizens throw oranges at people passing in horse-drawn carts who wear protective masks reminiscent of ancient armour who represent the nobility. And it signifies
this is great.
The people's rebellion against the tyranny of people running the city in Ivrea in historical times.
That sounds absolutely amazing. An orange is quite, I mean, as we know, as Jeanette Winterson, they're not the only fruit. Are you allowed to, would a kiwi, what happens if you got socked in the jaw with a kiwi fruit, Andrew?
I'd rather being, the kiwi fruit sounds more my kind of thing. I think an orange could quite
Well,
kind
this
of
is what
hurt.
I was just thinking.
Are they like,
that's quite a heavy
fruit.
Are
they like marmalade oranges, like the big ones?
I think they're a big
like
robust,
a Satsuma?
I think I am imagining a big robust sort
a
of Seville
orange
type
or a Seville orange. Yeah.
Which could do someone a bit of an injustice, but I guess if you're wearing a protective mask, reminiscent of ancient armour, you're probably all right. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Your
yeah.
guess is as good as
What's,
mine.
Tom, I mean, Andrew favours a kiwi fruit. If you had to be pummeled with fruit in a kind of old-fashioned style stocks situation, what would be your fruit of choice?
Probably a very ripe peach.
Yeah.
But it's got a stone in the middle. Yeah.
What about a kumquat?
I don't know how my kumquats are today.
It could get stuck in your ear, a kumquat.
It would get stuck in his hair,
it's difficult. What about a grape? Something small?
Yeah. So.
What would you choose?
A seedless grape. I think that's pretty
Would you just tough it out? Pineapple, bring it.
Bring it.
Each to his own. Maybe we could try that out next week.
Next week, we'll be talking about which sort of veg you'd like.
Prickly pear. That would be bad.
Yeah, I'd probably try and avoid anything with a heavy-duty
prickle
on it. Ho!
Well,
is there? Any, is there?
I think we should.
Is there, are there any more news events for our one remaining listener to chortle over?
No, I think that's a pretty good serving for everyone, isn't it?
I love that. I think that's the best news roundup we've had of the year, don't you, Andrew? We started really strong.
I love it. And a fruit salad special when you get out of here, mate.
Thank you, Tom Edwards.
It's now been 5 years since Egypt's Tahrir Square drew the eyes of the world as the seeming epicentre of a revolutionary political shift sweeping the Arab world. We are, of course, talking about the Arab Spring that saw governments topple in nations ranging from Tunisia to Libya and Yemen and rattled rulers in states such as Bahrain and Syria.
Jack Schenker is a London-based journalist and regular Monocle contributor who's been covering Egypt since those events kicked off back in 2011. The story of how and why that uprising took place and where the Arab world's most populous nation is headed today. It's the subject of his new book, The Egyptians, A Radical Story. And Jack's with us now. Welcome to the programme, Jack.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So we announced the title of the book, The Egyptians. So this is very much the story of a people at a certain time rather than trying to take on the monolith that is Egypt as a state, as a history, all the rest of it.
Absolutely. The title is very deliberate in that respect. We didn't want to call it Egypt because it's not your conventional tale of elites and counter-elites, Mubarak, his military successors, Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, or President Sisi, who overthrew Morsi. It's the tale of ordinary Egyptians, ordinary citizens who have been muscling their way onto the political stage over the past half decade and confronting political exclusion and economic exclusion, state violence along the way. And I wanted to tell an alternative narrative, one that wasn't entirely about defeat and failure and the limits of mass protest. And that's what I've tried to do in the book.
And that feeling of not wanting to present this just as a defeat, to the outside world, it seems like an absolute kind of... they started from here and they ended up in the same spot. But for you, when you've charted that narrative, you've been there as a correspondent for many years, do you feel that something did shift, that there were gains, there were wins? Because from the outside, when we look for the ordinary Egyptians, it feels like they've gone back to a time when it's very difficult to express yourself politically, the right to go into the streets and, you know, shout your beliefs has disappeared once again. We see all kinds of clamps down. But do you feel that there were wins?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you're completely right. The scale of state repression in Egypt today is not only as bad as it was under the Mubarak regime, but in many ways even worse. I spoke to a human rights defender and a prominent investigative reporter last weekend who was saying this is the worst we've seen in generations. We're seeing... activists, both Islamist and secular, plucked from the streets during the day, taken from their beds at night. We're seeing crackdowns on cafes and publishers and cultural institutions of all kinds. We saw almost 500 people killed by the Egyptian security forces last year, more than 600 tortured in police stations. So I'm certainly not denying that the state of oppression is a very, very intense place. What I'm trying to show is that something fundamental shifted with the revolution. I argue in the book that it was a hurricane that blew just as forcibly through the family dining table and the school playground and the college lecture hall as it did the corridors of government. There is a reconceptualization of the relationship between citizens and the state. And although at the moment this regime has a degree of popular support, you can tell by the scale of repression how nervous it is and how vulnerable it feels and how certain it is that the next wave of unrest will come.
But that shift you talk about, if you were living under Mubarak and if you're living now under Sisi, in what ways would you have seen any gains or any shift in the way that your daily life unfolds?
Well, it depends on where you are. In the book, I try and tell the stories of people who lived a long way away from Tahrir Square. So kind of individual communities such as the Bedouins on the north coast who fought off the army to reclaim land, which they say was stolen from them in order to build a nuclear power plant. I look at to cities like Damietta, where because of a local factory that was polluting the fisheries and the rivers and the farmlands, there was a local uprising. You don't hear about this in the international media, where they forced out the security forces and reclaimed the city for themselves for 11 days. And, you know, that factory has now been stopped from operating. So in these localized contexts, now these are often transitory moments. You see the old forces retake control after a certain period of time. But I think that by enacting these moments of resistance and enacting these moments of autonomy and agency, many Egyptian citizens have started to say, well, we want to find a way to make the state serve us rather than the other way around. And they're confronting rulers who cannot and will not change. And what I argue in the book is that's a fundamental, elemental contradiction that hasn't been resolved. And this right now, this is not what stability looks like.
And how generational is it, Jack? I mean, when you mentioned that this was a hurricane that swept across dining room tables as much as across the corridors of power, do all the people sitting around that family dining table think the same? I mean, Egypt's a very young country, isn't it? I mean, is there a huge groundswell of disenfranchised youth there? Is that very much the order of the day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the revolution first began, 2/3 of Egypt's population had lived their entire life under a single president, Hosni Mubarak. I remember just around the corner from where I lived, on the side of one of downtown Cairo's most famous bars, Horeya, there was a graffiti in English and Arabic saying, "I want to see another president before I die." And, you know, what we've seen since then is certainly a youth-led series of revolts. Most of the people I interview, and I interviewed dozens of revolutionaries in different contexts over the last few years, most of them begin their stories not with Tahrir Square and confronting security forces. They begin their stories with the family living room and shouting matches with parents and notes scrawled and left defiantly on the bedroom door saying, "I'm going down to join the protests, you know, do what you want," and you know, escapes out of the bedroom window. So certainly there is.
Can you wash my shirt?
Right, exactly. You know, it's got a bit grubby recently. There is definitely a generational element to it, and you're seeing that in lots and lots of different contexts, not just, as I say, on the national political stage, but within workplaces, within academia, within the business world as well. You've got lots of young people who feel energized, but you've also got, to be honest, exhaustion on the part of those young people, because, you know, you had this great groundswell of hope and opportunity and this sense that anything was possible. And as you rightly alluded to, Andrew, you've had this crackdown and the closure of that space. But what I believe is that political imagination, that moment of possibility, can't be completely sealed off. And as Sisi's regime begins to make mistakes, as it begins to lose popular support, the memory of these uprisings, the memory of this relentless unrest will drive kind of further waves of disruption.
And tell me, as you said, it is about the Egyptians. And what marks out Egypt for you as a unique place? Because when you look across, you don't have to go far to be in Saudi Arabia. It's certainly not Saudi. It's certainly not Libya. It's certainly not any of the countries to the south. When you were there, what is it that makes Egypt so special? Is it the vastness of its population for a country in the region? There is an amazing degree of education even now. What makes Egyptians special, do you think?
Well, first of all, as you say, the demographics. I mean, Egypt is the most populous country in the Arab world. It has 90 million citizens at the moment, and that's projected to rise and rise. You've also got a dwindling water supply and conflict over the Nile. So you've got a ready-made, very, very important tension at the heart of one of the most geopolitically important regions on the planet. So that alone, I think, makes Egypt special. But there's also a very long history and lineage of dissent and resistance. And again, something I try and show in the book is that the 25th of January 2011, the day the revolution broke out, was not day zero when it comes to Egyptians confronting their dictatorship. They're not just in colonial times and in the 1940s and 50s, but throughout the 2000s, in the decade running up to the revolution, you saw workers, you saw communities, you saw pro-democracy activists in different spaces and in different contexts taking to the streets, pushing back against the red lines, I think more so than many other Arab countries. And it's that history and that institutional memory of resistance which has driven much of the unrest that we're seeing today.
Alan Lane have done you a nice job with the cover, Jack, and it alludes to, you know, that very contemporary form of protest, a kind of almost a Banksy-ish Nefertiti there with a gas mask on and graffiti paint and stuff. I wanted to ask you about how mediated it's been since the Arab Spring, you know, whether we're talking about youth again and the people protesting, how their behavior has changed because of the media attention, and when there hasn't been so much media attention, how to grab it back, because that's such an important, you know, the keys to the kingdom are kind of the TV cameras, I suppose, to a certain extent, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, just for viewers, listeners at home who can't see it, the cover includes this graffiti image of the pharaoh queen Nefertiti wearing a gas mask. And that was an image created by the Egyptian graffiti artist El Zeft, who very kindly gave us his permission to use it. And I think in terms of Egyptian youth marching through the streets and facing down these kind of black-clad, helmets-down, shield-holding security forces and holding aloft symbols like that, there was a degree of appealing to Western viewers and saying, for so long, your visualization of our land has been about this, about ancient Egypt, yeah, about a country in which things used to happen and don't happen anymore, a static kind of national museum piece. And now we are reclaiming those symbols and using it to show that, no, we can keep on making history today. So yeah, that's very important. Of course, in the first few days of the revolution, people were desperately seeking out international media correspondents, foreign correspondents such as myself, and saying, please tell the world what is happening. Show them Mubarak's violence. Since then, as a result of the counter-revolution, the state crackdown, you've had this very destructive, very poisonous, chauvinist, nationalistic strand of kind of national discourse, which says foreigners are potential spies, they're potential enemies, they're trying to destroy Egypt. And that's made many people distrustful. So it's far, far harder for journalists to operate at the moment.
And is that a generational thing as well? I mean, are there young sort of very neocon Egyptians who sort of sold their beliefs up the river, or who really want to sort of believe in this crackdown?
Well, you know...
is it less easy to find them and less easy to talk to them? Maybe?
It varies. I mean, it's certainly, I think on the whole, one is more likely to kind of come across younger Egyptians who are sympathetic to the revolution and who are sympathetic to the revolution's aims. But again, it's not entirely along generational lines. The fundamental contradiction is between those that believe in the old ways that the state used to operate in, which is this very patriarchal, authority-led, I am the political master, you can beg for concessions, you can petition me for resources, but you can never exist as a political equal, you can never exist as a citizen. That's the old way. And then there are new ways that have been, you know, thrown up by the revolution, which are about, you know, having autonomy and agency for oneself. And there are young people and old people on both sides of that divide, and people from different religious backgrounds and different geographical backgrounds and different class backgrounds on both sides of that divide.
Jack, just everyone, a little bit about your personal story and your connection with Egypt, because you went pre-revolution, you began your relationship with the country, and then you stayed. I think there were moments where you must have thought, God, what am I doing here? I thought this would be an interesting place to post myself for a little while. Tell us about your journey and your determination to stay connected to the story, I guess.
It's the story of my life, waking up in the morning and asking myself, what am I doing here? Well, you know, I first went out to Egypt at the beginning of 2008, and I travelled overland from London. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. I decided the best way to do that was to go and freelance and basically embark on this adventure at the heart of the Middle East. And I didn't know then what would happen, but I did see that one of the fundamental divides in the region was between Western-backed autocrats and the populations that they ruled. And there were times in the late 2000s where it was very difficult pitching to international media outlets, trying to persuade them that what was going on in Egypt, the things I was referring to before, these huge strike waves, these communal protests, added up to anything. A newspaper, which shall remain unnamed, I remember famously asking them whether I could write a story about the National Circus going on strike, which to me was both a colourful and colourful kind of news article and also an insight into these kind of cracks below the surface. And the editor of that newspaper replied, "Not really our thing. Is there anything going on with the pyramids?" To which I replied, "Well, they're still there the last time I checked." So, yeah, so you know, that gives you a sense of the kind of news coverage that Egypt was getting in those days. But to be fair, once the revolution began, the kind of lens swung round.
Was there a moment then when you had to say to yourself, okay, this looks as though it's going to get hairy. Did I come here to write about, you know, tagines and Kulthum, or am I going to kind of get on the plane and leave, or am I going to stay and and get involved?
I mean, I knew I was going to stay and get involved from the very moment it began because, you know, in those years before the revolution, the thing I was most interested in was forms of popular resistance, was forms of protest. Those were the things I was reporting on, even when I was occasionally made to write an article about the pyramids. Those were the main things I wanted to focus on. And so once the revolution began, and I think many foreign correspondents will tell you this, it turned the wider world upside down and it turned our own personal worlds upside down. It was the most thrilling and intoxicating and discombobulating days of my life. And I live, you know, as ridiculously overwrought as this sounds, I live on with those memories every day now, just, you know, as all Egyptians do. And I feel very connected. In the book, I make the point that I am not writing as an objective observer. I'm writing as a partisan and someone who believes in the Egyptian revolution and believes in the things that it's fighting for and very much wants them to succeed.
Just finally, when we were lining up the guests for this show and Andrew and I were discussing a few things, we realised we were going to have a lady who's going to be the guest after you, who's written a book about con artistry, and you were on before, and Andrew thought it'd be good to ask you a question about pyramid selling schemes. I know, being a consummate journalist, do you have an answer to that?
Is Andrew trying to sell me a pyramid scheme?
Well, yeah, exactly.
Is this sort of Bernie Madoff at the heart of Midori House?
I think it's a big thing. It's a big mirage. And I think it's all made of polystyrene.
If both guests had been on here at the same time, then that was my point.
Andrew's questions are about a Potemkin village.
Well, let me just say that if Andrew ever wants me to invest in the far more substantial than a house of cards that is the Monocle Empire, I would be more than happy to contribute my meager savings towards it.
See, he's good at everything. He's got light and shade.
He's got light and shade. Jack Schenker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Time for some new music now. Some anthemic synth pop is the order of the day. This is Austin, Texas's Shearwater with A Long Time Away.
Breaking the clouds like a crack in the cylinder. Another's blow on the beach and a wreck in the water. As the shadow rides on the face of your innocence, you feel the shock in your eyes and the shaking in your own hand.
Well, that was Shearwater with A Long Time Away. You are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Maria Konnikova is a journalist and author whose work regularly focuses on the field of psychology. The Russian-born US writer received her PhD in psychology from Columbia University and has gone on to succeed in fields ranging from television production to writing. The latter is regularly featured in titles such as The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, to name but a few.
Her first book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, asked whether the general public could train their brains to think like the famed fictional sleuth. And her latest book, The Confidence Game, looks at how confidence tricksters use psychology to dupe even the most hardened cynics. And she joins us now on the line from New York. Maria, welcome to the programme. First of all, then, it was how to think like a detective. Is this sort of how to think like a criminal?
Well, unwittingly, yes. I realized the parallel only after I finished the book, and then I realized, oh God, what have I done? Because as I was rereading it, I realized, you know, I'm not just helping understand how this works and why we're victims, but in a way, if you want to use this as a training manual for how to deceive people and get them to do what you want them to do, it's not a bad read for that type of information.
That's a critical quote. We'll save for the back cover. The way the book's set out is kind of like that, isn't it? It's kind of how to bring people in, how to reveal your hand, when to do it. It's kind of set out like a kind of step-by-step guide, a very discursive one, isn't it? But nonetheless, a bit of a guide.
This is true. It is structured like a long con, and I did that on purpose so that people would see how it's possible for even incredibly intelligent, well-educated, skeptical people who know all about con artists, know exactly what they are, how it's possible even for those types of people to fall victim. And I think in order to do that, I needed to lay it out from start to finish in a way that brings people in and shows, okay, you know, now we're engaging your emotion, now we're telling you the story, now we're using these tactics. And the entire time, you don't quite realize what's happening until it's too late and the confidence game is over.
Maria, has the nature of confidence tricks changed with the internet, with a digital age? We read so many stories in papers all around the world of people who are contacted by somebody who claims to be their potential lover, a potential investor, somebody with, you know, money to give away, it seems. And when we read them from the outside looking at these tales, it seems impossible to believe that anyone, you know, rather than a fool, would have ever gone along with them. But then when you meet these people or see them on TV or hear them telling their stories, maybe there's a little bit of vulnerability or a need to be wanted in some of these people. But on the whole, many of them just seem like regular people who somehow, it's bit by bit, they got pulled into something and they never kind of looked back over their shoulder to think, how did I get to this point?
I think that's absolutely right. I think the nature of it hasn't changed, and it's always like that. It's just become more ubiquitous online. And what ends up happening is we are so incredibly good at figuring it out when we're reading about it, when it's happening to someone else. Then we're beautifully objective and we say, oh man, you're such a sucker. How did that happen? When it's happening to us, we think in a totally different way. So that same mantra of, you know, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is, only applies to others. Because whenever something good happens to us, we never think it's too good to be true. We think it's perfect because we, of course, are the types of people who deserve very good things happening to us. And the con artist is a really deft operator. It's not like right away someone calls you and says, congratulations, you are about to make $5 million. Well, I guess that might happen sometimes, but not usually. Usually it's a relationship that's developed over a period of time where you build up trust, where you start pulling people into the story bit by bit. And by the time that the red flags, or at least the red flags to an outside observer, appear, they're not red flags to you, to the person who's actually involved in this, because you're already emotionally invested. And once we're emotionally invested, we become incapable of looking at things rationally.
And just tell me on that, the nature of the people who get pulled into these things. The US has been home to some extraordinary examples, you know, the Bernie Madoff case, for example, where, you know, investors, again, looking back over the shoulder, it seemed impossible to believe that people really thought they were going to earn this kind of rate of interest or get this kind of return on their investment, but people did believe in it. When you look at somebody like you know, involved in one of those cases, and somebody involved in one of these more, you know, simplistic internet confidence tricks, are there unifying elements there?
Well, between those two, there are actually aren't that many. So when people tried to figure out, is there a profile of your typical victim, they found that every type of con has a profile, but that profile can be incredibly different. So for instance, something like a lottery scam. So this is something that's much more elementary, one of these online scams quite often. There, if you lack an education, if you've never finished high school, that's something that will make you very vulnerable. But for an investment fraud, the better educated, the more intelligent you are, the more vulnerable you are. So it's basically something that's protective against one kind of scam makes you the perfect victim for the other. And the only thing that seems to unify across types, and even still, it's not always apparent, but this is the one thing that kind of goes across the greatest number of categories. And that's not a personality or a demographic trait. So it's not greed, it's not honesty, gullibility, it's nothing like that. Instead, it's the situation in which you happen to find yourself at this point in your life. So situations of great change can make us emotionally vulnerable. And those can be negative or positive changes. So a divorce, a loss of a job, those are negative changes, obviously. positive changes can be a new job. So suddenly you're moving to a new city. You have an entirely new set of circumstances to which to get used to, and it's really exciting and wonderful. But once again, your frame of reference has shifted. And in those moments, we start craving kind of certainty and stability and meaning. And con artists sense that, and that's what they provide. And so we become much more vulnerable as marks.
And I wonder if we can try and get inside the head of a con man or lady, Maria. Do they always think they're bad? I mean, we might read your book and think that, you know, there are people with a very sort of mathematical, organized way of thinking who are methodologically ripping people off or whatever. But do people kind of do it by accident quite a lot of the time and then kind of get found out, find themselves out when they get found out?
Well, I think that the ones that end up becoming con artists, so the ones who actually do this as a profession, don't usually do this by accident. They do it on purpose, but none of them, or I have yet to meet one who's said, I'm a bad person. Mm. I think that they have wonderful ways of justifying and rationalizing exactly what they do. So I write about the dark triad of traits that a lot of con artists possess, and that's psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. And psychopathy is a lack of empathy that allows you to basically be emotionally disengaged from what you're doing. And so you can rationalize it by saying, well, you know, I'm not doing anything bad. Narcissism actually, I think, is the key because it gives you a sense of entitlement. It's not just an overblown ego, but it's saying, I deserve this more than you. And so you deserve to be a victim if you fall for my tricks. And a lot of the con artists I spoke with, this is exactly what they said. They said, hey, you know, if they believed in it, sucks to be them. It's not my problem. That means that I deserve it more. And the final part, Machiavellianism, isn't so much rationalization as the ability to persuade people and to get them to do what you want them to do. I had a fascinating experience when I was on air a few weeks ago with a con artist. He was a professional game fixer, a gambler who ran crooked games for decades. And now he was in his 70s, retired, had written a book about it. And we were talking, and I don't remember what I said to prompt this, but he responded. He said, well, I agree with everything you said, but I'm not a con artist. I am a professional gambler, and I'm a really good-hearted person. And I was silent for a second because in my head I was thinking, well, you are a con artist. You're not a professional gambler. Professional gamblers don't fix games. But in his own mind, he was not a con artist.
It's fascinating stuff, Maria. And certain elements of what you're saying remind me of The Psychopath Test, John Ronson's book, actually.
Yes.
And I wonder whether you see any, I mean, not wanting to make parallels where there are none, but whether you see this behavior writ large in business and in politics in the United States, but across the world as well, especially in those the first two of the three character traits that you said, the psychopathy and the narcissism. Do you see this sort of legalized and made okay by the fact that it happens in such large playgrounds like politics and business?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is no black and white dividing line between what is and is not a con artist. I think it's shades of gray. And you see not just the same characteristics. By the way, there are some quite funny studies, actually, if you think about it, that look at the prevalence of the dark triad in different populations. And you see things like business school students, and all of a sudden, all of them are scoring off the charts in everything, as if you suddenly, you know, found a bunch of con artists and were testing them. But obviously, they go on to be businessmen and marketers and advertisers and politicians and all sorts of things that we see as legitimate. So you start realizing that not just a lot of the personality traits, but also a lot of the approaches can be used in quite legitimate worlds and in what we perceive as legitimate ways. I think any single profession where you're trying to convince people, to persuade people, to sway them and get them to do something, we all have a bit of a con artist in us in that sense. So do I. I mean, I'm a writer and I do a lot of what con artists do. I try to weave compelling narratives. I try to pull people in emotionally. I try to change their minds or their viewpoints or kind of get them to see something. And that's not altogether dissimilar.
Maria, tell me, you've written about many cases going back hundreds of years. You've met contemporary con artists and you've met their victims. you've dug into all of these stories. Do you kind of like these characters? Because the interesting thing is, in popular, well, in TV, in films, the hustle is something that we watch from the outside, and we kind of admire these people. When you got to the end of your book, did you come across characters you thought, okay, I understand that they didn't do the right thing here, maybe, but wow, they're kind of interesting.
Well, I think it's really difficult not to develop a sort of grudging admiration for them, because, you know, a lot of them don't commit crimes in the way that we think of crime. You know, they don't steal anything. They're not breaking into your home. They're not mugging you. You are actually giving them things, and the way that they're able to gain people's trust, it is an art. And you do kind of admire all artists because they're skilled. They're very, very good at what they do. That said, I mean, you obviously have to remember that they ruin lives. And most of them, you know, they leave a lot of not just despair, but terror. I mean, there are people who commit suicide who've been conned in their wake. And you can't dismiss that. So it's a very difficult balance to strike. I had to stop talking to a number of con artists because they were way too charismatic, and I found myself sympathizing too much with them, and I had to kind of remove myself and say, wait, you're not being objective, because they're not letting you be objective, because they're great, fun, charismatic, wonderful people. It's easy to forget kind of the trail of destruction that they leave in their wake.
Was fascinating stuff. Maria, thank you very much for your time. The Confidence Game. Can we say, Andrew, that it's in all good bookshops? We can, can't we?
It certainly should be.
It's persuaded me anyway. Maria, thank you very much.
Thank you guys so much. This was a lot of fun.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
The Calvert Journal, based in London, is a title seeking out stories of artistic creativity from a country that doesn't always have the most open and inviting shopfront to visitors, Russia. The organisation looks at fields ranging from art and design to fashion and architecture that the West might want to know a little bit more about. Its base is the Calvert 22 Gallery in London's East End, and from next week, a new series of events showcasing the influence of Soviet-era Russia on nations across Africa will begin at the space, and it's called Red Africa. The two regions have closer ties than one might first assume. Back during the Soviet era, Russia's free education scheme offered foreign scientists, doctors and artists an attractive destination in which to hone their skills. And as part of the Red Africa season, curator Dr. Mark Nash will be exploring film, photography, propaganda and public art to trace African connections to the Soviet Union from next week in his exhibition, Things Fall Apart. And Mark joins us now. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Now, this is a fascinating one. The intro was a little bit on the long side, and you might know why, because people will be scratching their heads and going, Soviet-era Russia and Africa, where on earth does that come from? And more importantly, what does it look like? So what was the kickoff for this particular show, Mark?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, Calvert have been doing work with Russian and Eastern European art for a long time, I think 8 or 9 years. In fact, I did a show with filmmaker Isaac Julian for them, called Reimagining October, about 8 years ago. So they've had quite a good track record of showing contemporary work from not just Russia, but the former Eastern Bloc as well. And at one point, I was talking to the founder, Nonna Matikova, and saying, well, you're selling yourself short because you're not talking about the important influence of the Soviet Union in the rest of the world, particularly Africa and Asia, where, for example, there were these scholarship programs, so people could study in the Soviet Union for free. And of course, they were supposed to be good communist cadres and go back and develop socialism in their countries of origin. But a lot of people learn to become engineers, doctors, as well as artists. So it started from that kind of observation. And then we were invited, or I was invited, to develop a project for them, starting with this concept of the Socialist Friendship Scholarship series.
And talking about the art and artifacts in the show as well, what are we looking at? We're looking at sort of public art? We're looking at grandiose schemes, which we might
no,
have...
No, not really. I mean, well, two things. One is that this is a research exhibition, I would say. So it's showing a range of artists whose work raises issues to do with the relationship of Soviet and communist kind of influence in Africa. For example, there's the project of Yevgeny Fix, who has been collecting representations of African Americans in the Soviet Union, both before and after the Second World War. That's a kind of rolling set of images, basically, of popular culture. Then there's some quite, I would say, almost head-banging abstract presentations from the archive of Joseph Tito, because Tito was very much involved in developing the non-aligned movement and traveled extensively in Africa in order to get the support of various independent countries. And then in between, we have some photography, some photographs by Isaac Julian, some sculpture by Portuguese Mozambican artist Angela Ferreira. And in terms of public art, we have some maquettes and another moving image work by this South Korean artist, Choi Won-jun, who's been documenting the work of the Mansudae Company. These are the guys who produce all these massive North Korean sculptures. And in fact, in the New York Times a couple of days ago, there was a whole piece about how they're doing a massive work for Cambodia. So they're still, the North Koreans are still out there promoting a certain kind of socialist, realist public art. So it's quite a wide range of different kinds of work.
And was it one-way traffic? I mean, or can you see African impressions on Soviet-era Russia?
Not really. I mean, I think there are obviously connections because from the 20s and 30s, Africans and African-Americans traveled to Russia because Russia was kind of officially not racist. It didn't discriminate. It was celebrating the African people who decided to migrate there. There were African-Americans who worked particularly developing the textile industry in the south, in Tashkent, and a lot of people decided to stay, and you have quite famous movie stars and people in Soviet film. Paul Robeson, obviously, but also Wayland Rudd, who gives his name to the Yevgeny Fix project.
And in terms of, you said that this is almost a research exhibition, actually. How was the research done for this? I mean, this is a huge subject. Of course, you're talking about two continents, practically, crossing artistic swords here. How was all the material collated, and the curatorial job must have been a tough one? You must have had to kill a lot of darlings in the process, right?
Well, I shouldn't be selling my own exhibition short, but I mean, it's a small exhibition. It could be very large. It could be in the Royal Academy. That would be great. Mm. But it came out of work that was being done anyway when I was at the Royal College of Art running the curating program, and a number of the students and colleagues were interested in this area. So I brought them together under the auspices of Calvert, and we had a series of seminars over 2 years under the rubric of socialist friendship. At the same time, we linked up with other groups doing similar work in Moscow, particularly with the Garage Gallery up there. And in a way, you have to just follow particular leads. So in our case, there's a lead through the Lusophone Portuguese-speaking countries, which were the last ones to become independent. So several of the artists and several of the people we were working with have connections there. And I think it's really an ongoing process. So it's more like this is a project that we hope other people might want to get involved with. And we certainly don't think we have anything really definitive to say. We're just saying, in a way, people have forgotten, have talked so much about the end of the Cold War that they've actually forgotten that during that Cold War period, there was much more of a strategic balance between East and West. And those of us who are old enough to remember actually thought the Soviet Union and the socialist countries had quite a lot to offer. Now that's sort of been written off. And we think, well, it's a good idea to look back at that period. And that's what the artists that we're featuring are also doing, in a way. they're not necessarily communist. I would say they're probably socialist or socialist in their leanings, but they're just saying, let's not forget this important nearly 50-year period when the world was structured very differently in terms of the geopolitical space, if you know what I mean.
And your show starts just as at the Science Museum, the Cosmonauts show is just finishing, actually, which is an interesting, hopefully not simplistic counterpoint, but the idea that there is a great nostalgia, actually, that in the West, in London, you can put on a show, admittedly in a Russian-run space, Cover 22, but where there is even just something as simple as nostalgia is allowed to happen and be glorified. Is there a bit of, you know, unashamed sentimentality and nostalgia in the show as well?
Well, not really, but I think it's very easy.
It's not a bad emotion.
It's not a bad emotion. In fact, if it's still running, I must see that show, because I did when in 81 when I went to Moscow the first time. Then I managed to go to the Space Center, Baikonur, and see the Tereshkova's spacesuit, and she was minute. I mean, a little bit bigger than the dog, but you know, it was,
just one up from Laika.
one up from Laika. But again, in a way, that notion of nostalgia, it's also to do with the fact that the Soviet Union had, for better or worse, a kind of socially inclusive policy. It's just the reality wasn't, people didn't experience the reality of the ideology they were living. But is that so different to how we live today when, you know, the gap between rich and poor is more extreme than it's ever been, in fact?
And just finally, to give a flavour of some of the of some of the feel of some of the art that you're showing there, Mark, do we see African exhortations to work and labour, Stakhanovite constructivist sorts of things, or is this a far more sort of subtle, far more different stuff than that sort of very obviously communist art?
Yeah, there's really not much communist art there, apart, as I say, from the North Korean. What we're really seeing are contemporary artists who are very much formed in a Western vocabulary, examining the past in different kinds of ways. So I think it makes most sense to an informed visual art audience, and in that way it represents a continuity with previous Calvert exhibitions. But I know in developing the journal and relaunching the space under the rubric of Red Africa, they want to include or reach a wider audience, which is why we're also doing a small film program, and they're doing a number of other events, including some music events and so on, to try and bring people in. Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff. We've kind of scratched the surface of it. Well, I hope we've scratched an itch as well at the same time for people's interest in Russian influence or Soviet influence African art. It's called Things Fall Apart. It's at Calvert 22 in Shoreditch. And Dr. Mark Nash is the curator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there we have it. I love today's show. I think it was a strong performance today from all comers.
Yes, it was indeed a fine show. Can I just say, I think it's sometimes tricky when people kind of, you know, come into the studios around the world and they have to kind of explain quite complicated things. But I loved Maria because she was, yeah, she was so evocative about that book. And, you know, it's been great looking at her, but she was just a really great guest down the line.
She had a lovely voice, and it's, you know, it's not like anyone can write a really interesting book, of course, but it's quite difficult to be able to talk with the same sort of cogency and lightness of touch that she does in the book. Jack Schenker, regular Monocle voice, I loved him. And Dr. Nash from Calvert 22. He was very interesting about Soviet art.
Who you looked after on your own?
I looked after him on my own.
And, of course, Mr. Tom Edwards. He's good.
What about our friends behind the glass, Andrew? Shall we say thank you to those guys?
Well, let's say thank you to Tom Hall.
I think he's okay.
He was a bit wobbly early on.
We won't. Let's not phone with any extra information. Isn't it lovely to have the beautiful Claire Urban peeping at us through the glass as we speak as well?
1 month back in New Zealand seeing the folks.
I know. Let's not talk about the dream she had about me involving gin and tonics. It's not disgusting. She didn't know how strong to make it. I love that someone's had a dream involving gin and tonic.
Or just like serving suggestions.
Yeah.
Who has like deep dreams about serving suggestions?
I don't know. I think Claire needs a job upstairs on the entertaining pages of Monocle, right?
Yes.
So thank you to her. And who else do we need to thank?
I think that's about it.
Chiefly yourselves, listeners. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.